All right, so I'm going to start with your ending, which is taxing sugar drinks, for example. That was something that Bloomberg did in New York City, but he got very harsh feedback from the population, particularly the African American population, was very upset about that. How do we think about giving the people what they want versus giving people what they should have?
Yeah, Bloomberg suggested a restriction on the size of beverages. I don't think he wanted nothing sold in more than a 16-ounce portion. He didn't really propose an excise tax on sugary drinks in Manhattan or in the city of New York. The governor of New York proposed that, but then dropped the proposal very quickly. What I propose is the approach that's been taken now by a number of municipalities, and that's an excise tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. It was done in Berkeley in 2014, and then it was done in Philadelphia, then in San Francisco, in Oakland, in Boulder, Colorado, in Seattle. And where this tax has been set in place, it has driven down the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. It's driven up the consumption of bottled water. How did these taxes become acceptable to the population of these cities? In some cases, the tax was enacted by a popular ballot. Individual consumers aren't as opposed to these kinds of taxes as, of course, some lobby groups that can influence city councils or can influence state legislatures or can influence the Congress. If you can do it through a ballot issue, and if you can dedicate the revenue from the tax to something that's either health related or something that will benefit minority communities, that's a good way to get approval for these kinds of measures. Of course, these kinds of measures have only been enacted so far in cities that are heavily democratic, and they've only been enacted with external support, including support from the Bloomberg Foundation, to run the campaign to win the ballot contest.
Oh, you mentioned nutritional guidance as well as a possibility. We're starting to see nutritional guidance at fast food restaurants and other restaurants for that matter. Has that been effective in changing choices of what people order at restaurants when they see the calorie count, or do people look at it and just discount it?
Well, you're right. We now do have a law requiring calorie counts on menus in restaurant chains. It has to be on the menu, or it has to be on a display board. It has to be visible to those that are buying the foods. And these have had some effect. They probably had their greatest effect by nudging the providers of these foods to reduce the calorie content. It may not influence the behavior of the customers in these restaurants as much as it influences the behavior of the restaurants that are making up the menus. But in either case, it's a plus, it's a benefit. There is a risk, of course, that only those who are already health conscious and watching their calorie intake are going to be careful observers of the calorie counts on the menus. But the restaurant industry fought hard against these calorie counts and delayed them for a number of years, suggesting to me that they knew at least it was going to have an impact on the behavior of their customers.
But that would be their prediction. So just to kind of follow the logic through, imagine you're the Cheesecake Factory and you're offering a salad and it's got 1600 calories or some crazy number on it, right? And so Cheesecake Factory says, oh my God, when I publish the 1600 calories, no one's going to want to eat this salad, so I better change the content of the salad to 1200. And then when they find out that in fact people prefer the 1600 calorie to the 1200, isn't the first inning of the game they change it to a 1200 calorie salad, but in the second inning, when they find out they preferred the 1600 calorie, they just shift right back to the 1600 calorie?
Well, we'll have to find out. This new law has only been in place for a couple of years, and we don't have good studies yet, good careful studies of the response by the food service industry. My guess is you could reduce the calorie count of most restaurants serve salads just by cutting down a little bit on the dressing. The salad would look the same, and it would virtually taste the same, and it would be much better for you. I have hopes that these kinds of informational messages are going to be a good corrective to careless behavior on the part of both the food service industry and consumers. But back to something else that you started with, and that's nutrition guidance, not just a calorie count, but telling consumers something about the fat content, the protein content, the degree of processing, the salt. These are important bits of information that are currently available to U.S. purchasers of packaged food products by looking at the Nutrition Facts Panel, which is usually on the side of the package. It's fine print and small numbers. You have to work hard to make good use of it. In other countries, including in Europe, they're now requiring nutrition guidance on the front of the package, not on the side of the package. And it has to have easily understood at a glance value. In the UK, they have a traffic light system where you get things colored either red or yellow or green. If you're a shopper, you don't have to read for 3 minutes to find out if you've got too much sodium. You'll just see sodium red, and that's going to tell you that you'd probably be better staying away from that product. I'd like to see a system like this in the United States, either on the front of the packages, or an alternative approach is a front of shelf guidance system. We have one. It's called Guiding Stars. It was actually designed by a food retailer, the Ahold Delhaize retail chain, and it gives you either 1, 2, or 3 stars, depending upon whether their algorithm finds the food product to be good or better or best for you. And you might be curious, how honest is this system? Can we really trust a retail chain to grade the foods that they're trying to sell to us? Well, when one U.S. Chain, Hannaford's, put in this system, they discovered that 2/3 of the packaged food products in the store didn't get any stars at all. So it was an honest system. It did reveal how many of the products being sold in supermarkets have too much processing, too much salt, too much sugar, and too much fat.
I thought the most interesting or shocking aspect of your book was your discussion about organic food, namely that the science that you said showed that organic foods weren't any healthier than those that were not organic. Is this widely known? And if so, why do people pay the 54% more for this organic food? And should we have more of a public message to encourage people to stay away from organic foods and save the money, particularly among our poor citizens?
Well, it's widely known among nutrition scientists, but
But among nutrition scientists, they also know that Oreos and sugar is also bad for you. But you're requesting that society nudge people away from things that that community already knows. Should we be nudging people away from organic foods?
Oh no, organically grown foods are just as healthy as conventionally grown foods. There's no health reason to tell people they shouldn't buy.
Well, it costs 54% more. Should we have advertising saying, save your money, don't buy these organic foods?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's up to consumers who notice that these foods cost 54% more to make the decision, are they getting their money's worth? And that's, you know, there's more than one or two reasons why consumers might think they are getting their money's worth. They might think these foods are more nutritious. There's no science to support that, but they might also think, well, maybe they're safer because organic growers don't use synthetic pesticides, and maybe conventional foods have pesticide residues that I want to stay away from.
But you don't believe that, do you?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration has studied that very carefully. Toxicologists have studied that very carefully, and the pesticide residues on conventionally grown foods are so far below the tolerance thresholds that are set by these food safety agencies that no, I don't believe that pesticide residues are a consumer risk in countries like the United States. They are a risk in developing countries where foods are not repeatedly washed before they're put up for sale, and where pesticides are not as heavily regulated, and the application of pesticides is not as heavily regulated as in the United States, and where pesticide use is heavier than in the United States. The United States has reduced its use of insecticides by more than 80% since 1972. Most food consumers don't realize that. Most food consumers continue to be frightened away from pesticide residues by campaigns, by advocacy groups. There's an advocacy group called the Environmental Working Group that every year lists what it calls its dirty dozen food products with the highest level of pesticide residues. Well, the levels of residues that they find are so far below the tolerance levels, it's hard to describe these products as dirty. They're essentially all clean, and these are just the least perfectly clean. It's a little bit in any collection of food products, one is going to have more pesticide residues than the others, even if most of them have essentially none. So it's a little bit like warning swimmers away from the shallow end of a wading pool. But of course, consumers want to do what's best for themselves and their families, and they see a group promoting this list of dirty products, and they might choose not to consume them. I think it would be too bad, since the products include things like spinach and strawberries, which are very good for human health. And as I say, we don't consume enough fruit and vegetables right now. We shouldn't be staying away from perfectly healthy fruit.
The other interesting thing about your book was sort of encouraging the use of industrial farms over local farming. One point that you just reiterated was these industrial farms are increasingly more productive, are more productive with fertilizers, are more productive with pesticides, are more productive in creating healthy fruits and vegetables. Why is there this natural inclination in opposition to industrial farms, and why do you feel like you're pushing against the trend by articulating the benefits of industrial farms?
Well, the label industrial farms is itself something that's been created by opponents of using modern science in agricultural production. The opponents of modern science like traditional farms. They like small, diverse, local, chemical-free traditional farms. I don't think this is an effective model to employ, in part because of how much more food the marketplace is demanding these days. Right now, American agriculture is producing three times as much as it was producing in 1940. If we had tried to triple production using the techniques that were available in 1940, we would be doing vastly a greater environmental damage than we're doing today. I mean, we'd already reached the limit of what the methods of the past could do safely. Remember, when we expanded traditional production methods onto the drought-prone southern plains in the 1920s, the minute we hit a drought in the 1930s, it created the Dust Bowl, an environmental calamity, 400,000 environmental refugees. We're able to avoid that today because we've used nitrogen fertilizer, hybrid seeds, new equipment that can plant seeds without plowing. We have GPS-guided systems that tell equipment very precisely in the field when to use more and when to use less of inputs like lime and fertilizer. We have GPS systems now that can tell a roving piece of equipment in the field exactly where it is, down to less than 1 inch. And these systems are linked up to digital soil maps and to computer-operated variable application equipment that ensures we use only as much fertilizer, only as much nitrogen as that one part of the field needs, and no more. So we haven't increased fertilizer use in the United States since 1981, even though we've increased production by 46%. Pesticide use today is 18% lower than it was in 1981, even though we've increased production by 46%. I think that that industrial farms still do environmental damage. They still do too much environmental damage. But it's because of the quantity of food that the market is asking for. It's because of how much they produce. It's not because of how they produce it.
Okay. Thank you, Robert.